Hello, everyone, and welcome to Artscape, conversations on film, fine arts, performing arts, and arts education. I'm David Lemberg. Artscape supports the growth and development of young artists and performers everywhere. Artscape is made possible in part by the generous support of the Cambridge Art Gallery, located in Brentwood, California. Please visit us online at artscapemedia.com. If you'd like to receive a free transcript of this interview, please send an email to copy@artscapemedia.com and indicate the name of the guest in the subject line. Our next guest is Jenny Lynn Bader, playwright and author. Ms. Bader's plays include Manhattan Casanova, which just received its world premiere at Hudson Stage, and None of the Above, produced in New York and published in the collection Under 30, Plays for a New Generation. Ms. Bader has developed her plays at the Lincoln Center Directors Lab, the Women's Project Directors Forum, where she workshopped Memory Play starring Eli Wallach, and at the O'Neill Playwrights Conference, where she won the Edith Oliver Award. Ms. Bader co-authored the book He Meant, She Meant, The Definitive Male-Female Dictionary, published by Warner. In December, her one-act cycle, Out of Mind, Seven Short Plays with Some of the People Missing, will be produced at NYU Strasbourg. Let's welcome Jenny Lynn Bader.
Thank you. Hi.
Jenny Lynn, good morning. Thanks for being with us today on Artscape.
Good morning to you.
Well, Jenny, congratulations on your wonderful production, and I love your play titles. Could we start by talking about Out of Mind?
Absolutely. It's a play cycle I also informally call Out of Mind the Invisible Plays, because in each play there's a character who's invisible or missing for a different reason.
Uh-huh.
So in the first play, which is called The Third First Blind Double Date, in which a girl goes on a series of blind dates that also happen to be double dates, that also happen to come in succession, so they land up on the third first blind double date. The the girl finds herself in a quandary that her dates are invisible to her.
Wow.
She physically can't see them. They are visible to the couple that she's on the date with, but they are invisible to her and also to the audience.
That's pretty spectacular.
So I think that a lot of people find themselves in this quandary when they're dating, that their dates, they can't really see their dates on some level. So that play just literalizes that, and that was the first one of this series that I wrote. And then in the next one, not at all intending to refer back to the first play, I wrote it completely separately for a invitational 10-minute play festival at Primary Stages called the Moment of Bliss Festival.
Wow.
And I was trying to write a play about a moment of bliss, and I found myself writing about a child who's invisible and a babysitter who has to babysit this invisible child, who has to first find the child and then babysit her. And the child is in such a state of, the euphoria of childhood, runs so quickly and moves so fast that adults can't see her.
Wow.
And so it wasn't until after I wrote that play that I realized I had, two of them, and that maybe I was, subconsciously exploring this theme, which of course relates back to the whole project itself, because, the whole idea of the invisible has to do with the subconscious, and the subconscious is a terrible thing to waste.
Yeah.
So, in a way, all these seven pieces, they're traditional short comedies. They have quirky characters and funny situations and little plot twists. But underneath, there's this catch, which is you can't actually see all of the characters, and the pieces, they're light, the tone is celebratory, the people in them are eccentric, but at bottom there's a serious dynamic. They are all exploring new depths in their emotional lives, all participating in some way in moments of revelation, poetic, romantic, spiritual, personal transformation. And all the plays look at these kinds of moments of passion, moments of insight, moments of romance, the kinds of moments that totally change your life. Wow. And in these moments, people you could never see suddenly become visible to you.
So how long is the run, and when does Out of Mind open?
Out of Mind runs just the invisible plays become visible for a limited engagement at December 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th at NYU Strasbourg.
So if we're not able to get to them, what can we do?
Well, you'll have to, I don't know, look for them to become visible on, on my website.
At a theater near you, right?
Yeah. Some of these plays have been performed separately. One of them is published in a best 10-minute play anthology. Some of them, you know, become visible in forms of various festivals. What's interesting about this piece is, you know, theaters are always looking for what they call flexible casting. There are about 20 roles in the piece, and in the past I've seen it done. I saw a workshop at the Stanford Fringe Festival where six actors played the 20 roles. Mm-hmm. I saw it done in Delaware where seven actors played the 20 roles. I've seen it done with in a reading with four actors playing the 20 roles. And, of course, because this is a school, they're going to have 12 people in it.
Right.
So that's a really really fun for me to be part of that rehearsal process and to see each person really, really struggling with the dilemma of just, you know, one role or maybe two and not having to switch back and forth, which becomes the kind of challenge of the piece normally with the grown-up virtuistic actors.
So visibility, invisibility, I mean, that's a pretty interesting dialectic and also a pretty powerful metaphor.
Yeah, actually, as a radio person, you might find it interesting that one of the things, you know, even though I wrote the play separately, I went back for when they're, you know, performed together to try to find connections between them. And one of the links is that in each play, there's a radio station that the characters listen to. It's the same radio station, and although one play is, you know, set in a suburban living room and another is in a New York coffee shop, and, you know, they're each kind of all over the place, they're all in the same world.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose a radio station, you know, because the plays, you know, in exploring invisibility are really exploring voice in a way. And, you know, the idea of the disembodied voice and the idea of having, you know, faith in the absent. So, you know, whether absence does make the heart grow fonder or whether it's really out of sight, out of mind. which is why it's called Out of Mind, seven short plays with some of the people missing.
Jenny, I got it. And, you know, we've really explored this. I'm getting that this cycle of plays is rich and deep and that the audience is just in for an extraordinary experience.
Oh, I hope so.
Wow. So let's talk about your, Manhattan Casanova world premiere at Hudson Stage. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us about that.
Thank you. Well, Manhattan Casanova is a comedy about compulsive seduction. And it's really a comedy about two commitment-phobic people who meet. Because, you know, we often see comedies where, you know, one person is the commitment-phobe and the other one is trying to have a relationship. And I think that's funny, but I think there are so many commitment-phobes in the world today that it's even funnier to explore what happens when both are.
Right.
And in a way, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, and, you know, part of why I even first began thinking in, you know, my first invisible play, The Third First Blind Double Date, about creating invisible characters, that I was thinking, how could I have all these suitors in this one play? And, you know, with the restrictions of theaters looking for small cast vehicles, and I realized that I could have some of the suitors be invisible, because aren't they usually anyway? And similarly, in Manhattan Casanova, I was trying to think of ways to create roles for a lot of strong women, because that's something we don't see a lot. And, you know, I was trying to redress a bit the history of unfair gender ratios in drama. And I thought of this concept where what if all the women in the play are dating this one guy? So in the play, the main character is Charlotte Kaplan. She's a psychiatrist, and she's a very strong woman, and she's smart, and she knows to be, you know, skeptical of kind of impulsive infatuation and bad romantic choices, and she has a tendency to discourage her friends and patients from falling in love too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And she considers herself a scientist, and like a scientist, she, you know, notices trends and patterns, and at the beginning of the play, she starts to notice that there are a lot of people in New York City who are falling in love even more quickly than usual in a way that's rather alarming. And she notices it among her friends, she notices it among her patients, and then she realizes that they're all falling for the same guy. And then she meets him. And that's sort of the beginning of the story. And the seduction, which would occur in most plays sort of over time, happens actually very quickly. But then the twist is that we discover that Charlotte is also a compulsive seducer in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And also as commitment phobic as John Casey or our modern Giacomo Casanova is.
Mm.
And the play kind of asks the question of, can the Casanova reform, which I think is a question, you know, everyone has asked who's ever dated a commitment phobe or been one.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So, and what's funny about the play is that every guy I know thinks it's about him. They all want to know, you know, when I wrote it, did I write it before I met them? Did I write it? No, even men that I never dated, had nothing to do with. There's one guy who's a friend of a friend who's told our mutual friend he's convinced the play is about him, so he won't see a reading or production of it.
Well, we're men, of course.
That's right.
I'm thinking it's about me. So, Jenny Lynn, I'm thinking that this Manhattan Casanova would make the perfect film.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And earlier when you were talking about Out of Mind, you mentioned plot, you mentioned again here, plot twists. And again, this makes me think of film.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, jumping off the wagon for a moment, I'm wondering if you are doing any screenwriting.
I am doing some screenwriting. I'm actually working on a screenplay with my ex-boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
It's an idea that we thought of while we were breaking up. And we realized we didn't have a very good relationship, but we'd have a really good idea for a movie.
That's great. That's great.
So we've started working on that. And, I've certainly been approached about some of my plays turning into movies. And I've always tried to make sure that they were first produced as plays.
Right.
So that, you know, the choices that I make and the, you know, the words that I write will be, you know, fully realized before they get, you know, twisted and edited and changed, and I lose the, you know, rights to them and all that stuff. So, I haven't ruled out adaptations of the plays as features, but I have, I've always separately done screenwriting, and it's interesting. It comes back to the whole question of voice that we were talking about before with the invisible plays. So often playwrights are approached and they're told, well, you know, we're not looking for this kind of play now, but we really like your voice. Or, well, we don't do plays, but we love your voice, so can you write for television or movies?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I got, for a while, kind of suspicious of the idea of voice because it seemed to be a way of telling playwrights to write a different play or to not write a play or something. But the truth is that voice is a very, very powerful force.
Yes.
And when you're sitting in the theater, in a dark theater, listening to the voice of, you know, a Tom Stoppard or somebody like that, it's like being plunged into a warm bath of consciousness. You're just you just exist there with this voice, and the voice becomes, you know, palpable in a way and visible in a way. So it's a very, voice is one of those, you know, invisible things that people always talk about in the theater. The way people in the corporate world talk about, you know, thinking outside the box or something. You know, it's just one of those metaphors that people always throw about, but when you really start to think about it, I think there's something very, very deep there.
Yes, Jenny Lynn, thank you. Well, I'd like to talk about one more play, and then I'd like to look a little bit, although we've been talking about this under the surface, about your process.
Mm-hmm.
Could we talk about None of the Above?
Oh, sure. None of the Above is a world's first comedy about the SAT. It's a play in which an Upper East Side private school girl, who we kind of think we know, enters the door to discover a guy there who she thinks is going to be her drug dealer, and he turns out to be, much to her disappointment, her SAT tutor. And that then we start to discover that this guy isn't going away. She offers him, you know, she says that she'll just not study and not tell her parents that he didn't show up, and he'll get paid anyway, and pleads to go away, and he has absolutely no interest in studying for the SAT, and he refuses to go away, which she finds suspicious because she believes the world to be ruled by money. And the next thing you know, he turns out to have a very unusual deal with her parents, or their father,
mm-hmm.
where he's going to be paid nothing unless she gets a perfect score. And then he's going to be paid $100,000 plus his graduate school tuition.
Good deal.
So he's in it for about $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, discovered that she doesn't really do word problems or like math or anything, except when it comes to drug dealing, which he actually has kind of a head for figures. He realizes she has practical business skills, and indeed she asks him for a cut of the money. And that's when we actually start to watch her change on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the resources she really has. So, and both of the characters, I think, are characters that really surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Where we, you know, have a stereotype of what this person is, and they're not like that.
Mm-hmm.
At all.
So what a great high concept. And this was produced at the New George?
Produced by New George's.
Uh-huh.
And they did it at a theater called the Ohio Theater in Soho.
And None of the Above is in the collection Under 30, Plays for New Generation. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a wonderful book. It's a book of strong roles for young actors, because, you know, so many times you see, you know, you go to these school shows and you see people who are 17 or 25 playing, you know, 60 or 70-year-olds in these old-fashioned plays. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's really great vintage to produce a book like this, where
mm-hmm.
there's so many roles, all for younger people.
Jalen, thank you so much. So let's talk about your own process.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that writers write, and I'm wondering when you started.
When I started writing?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I have no idea. That's a good question. I'm really, when I was very young, I started writing, you know, what one writes in school, and, you know, poems and songs and
uh-huh.
stories. And it never occurred to me that I would do it professionally. I always thought I would get some kind of practical job in the writing world. I thought I would be a book editor or something.
Uh-huh. Work at Vogue.
Exactly.
Right.
Not that, but I really did imagine myself at a publishing house or something, which I guess is a kind of New York thing.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But I guess I suddenly, after college, found myself doing a million part-time jobs. Some of them involved reading plays, and some of them involved, evaluating plays, assistant directing plays, you know, those
mm-hmm.
kinds of theater jobs. And then I had some sort of jobs writing for little magazines. And at a certain point, I said to myself, you know, what's wrong with this picture? You read nothing but plays. You write everything but plays. And you are looking for a play to direct and can't find it.
Mm.
And that's when I wrote my first play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I put it in a drawer for a while, and then I showed it to a friend of mine who had so many critical questions that I put it for a drawer in for about another year.
Right.
And then I sent it in to a competition, and it was performed in that, and that was the beginning of my playwriting life.
Wow.
And I found actually that as a young woman, it was sort of much easier to get my plays out there in a written form than it was to promote myself as a director, because, you know, I looked like a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a way, it is to my advantage to be invisible.
Right. Right, I got it. So I'm wondering if you could say a bit about two people who are writing and who have yet to break out. You know, what is your counsel here?
Well, I guess one thing I would counsel them is to work really hard.
Yeah.
Because that seems to me to be the thing that characterizes those who ultimately are published and produced, a really strong work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think to, I wouldn't counsel young writers to get in a situation where they're being exploited, for example, you know, to be entering, you know, contests that have high entry fees, or mm-hmm. to be, you know, paying a lot to, you know, there's a lot of kind of unscrupulous things where they charge young writers, or, you know, they are splitting the box office with them, but they're also making them pay for a lot of the costs of putting a show up. But I would advise young writers not to be, to try not to turn assignments down.
Right.
Because, you know, my first two book contracts came because I wrote for a magazine which was not paying. And that I was recommended by a friend of mine who said to me, oh, you know, I'd like to, I was asked to write for this magazine for, you know, a magazine with 20-something writers, a Generation X magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I was asked to write for this Generation X magazine, but they don't pay anything, and I'm about to sell my screenplay for $1 million, I'm sure, so, but I gave them your name. And so I wrote a piece for this magazine called The Everlasting Yes, No, Maybe, about my theory that when women say yes, they often mean no, and when men say no, they often mean maybe.
Mm.
And that magazine piece, although I wasn't paid for it, ultimately led to first me being invited to write an essay for this anthology that was published by Norton, and then that also was the sample that led to my, you know, book contract with Warner, that he meant, she meant, the Definitive Male-Female Dictionary. In fact, that essay is reprinted in that book. So, you know, I wouldn't encourage people to take, you know, terrible assignments, but mm-hmm. I do believe that things can happen, things that pay little or nothing can lead to other things.
Right.
And not to be, you know, disdainful of small assignments.
Right, Jalen, thank you. The powerful story that you just shared.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, we've got a little time left. I'd like to at least touch on your new historical drama, and then I'm wondering about sources of inspiration.
Well, my new historical drama is called Petticoat Government. It's about Edith Wilson, a figure who I was always fascinated by because, you know, I had this understanding that she ran the White House during her husband Woodrow's stroke. And when I was approached by someone from Lincoln Center Director's Lab, they were doing something called the 20th Century Project, and they were looking for plays for about the different decades of the 20th century, and obviously I wasn't top of their list because they only had the teens, the 70s and the 80s left when they called me. So I said I would like to take the teens because I envisioned writing a piece about Edith Wilson and what a great heroic figure she was. But then when I started to do some research, I discovered that she was not a heroic figure at all. She was actually a terrible policymaker and made lots of terrible decisions, and really was much more concerned with her husband's health than about, you know, the health of the United States, and
mm-hmm.
was a really much more complex figure than I had thought. And indeed, I assumed, because, you know, the suffragists were around at that time, that she was a feminist interested in the right to vote, and actually she hated the suffragists because they always were tormenting her husband, and she was quite anti-feminist, quite traditional Southern woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I then thought, oh, now I need to write a piece about Edith Wilson, you know, the villainess. But then the more I got into it, the more I realized she was really neither a hero nor a villainess, but really a woman very much of her time who lived vicariously through the men she was with and then literally turned into them.
Hmm.
And wow. That's what the play is about. Wow. She was widowed. She was married to Norman Galt, a jeweler in Washington, D.C., and when he died, she became a jeweler, and she managed his store and was the first woman in Washington, D.C. to own and operate an electric car, and was a thriving businesswoman when she met the president, who himself had been widowed in the White House. And people will be surprised to know that it was not Michael Douglas, but it was Woodrow Wilson who was the first president to date and marry while in office. So they had there were a lot of really uncanny parallels between their time and now, mm-hmm. Which extra fascinating things, mm-hmm. to look at. But mostly I'm just, interested in this woman. And when you talk about sources of inspiration,
mm-hmm.
I think that I'm interested in the way that she is not what we think. And I'm interested in characters who defy our preconceptions,
mm-hmm.
who are not easily stereotyped or pigeonholed. I'm fascinated by different kinds of intelligence, conscious versus unconscious intelligence, intellectual versus instinctively intelligent people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in plays one often finds a divide between, the smart character and the dumb character, whereas I'm interested in the character who's really dumb and really smart at the same time.
Right.
And I also have repeatedly found myself drawn, and I say found myself because I don't, this is not the thing that I decide in advance. It's just something I've noticed looking at my work after I've written it. I'm really drawn to the conflict between science and art.
Hmm.
And I think in all of my plays, there's a question about that conflict, about the logical versus the creative, the quantitative versus the qualitative, the consciously intellectual versus the instinctively, and there's no, there's no preference, there's no,
mm-hmm.
answer. I'm interested in that struggle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jenny Lind, thank you for a brilliant conversation today.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
This is really much more fun than most radio.
Thank you. Our guest is Jenny Lind Bader, playwright and author. Jenny Lind's latest play, Out of Mind, 7 short plays with some of the people missing, will be produced this month, December, in New York City at NYU Strasbourg. Thanks for being with us on Artscape.
Thank you for having me.